Romans 16, verse 17 through 20 is what I'm going to read. Now I urge you, brethren, keep your eye on those who cause dissensions and hindrances contrary to the teaching which you learned, and turn away from them. For such men are slaves, not of our Lord Christ, but of their own appetites. And by their smooth and flattering speech, they deceive the hearts of the unsuspecting. For the report of your obedience has reached to all. Therefore, I am rejoicing over you. But I want you to be wise in what is good and innocent in what is evil. The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. The grace of our Lord Jesus be with you. All right, well, the title tonight, True and False Unity. True and False Unity. It doesn't necessarily flow out of anything that we talked about on Sunday. I know a lot of times I like to kind of do it that way. It's just a topic that I hear bantered around quite a bit in Christian circles. And I just found it interesting. It was something I just recently heard somebody bemoaning the lack of Christian unity amongst churches. And as I thought of that, and as I've just kind of reading through Romans here recently, and I was at the end and I was reading this, and you know, you get to Romans 16, just like you get to most of the end of the epistles, and Paul, a lot of times, it's easy to just fly by what he says because he's got all these names and it's like, he's just saying his goodbyes, you know? Greet so-and-so, greet so-and-so, so-and-so greet you, you know, this. Well, you got to be careful doing that. It's just like in the introduction of the epistles. A lot of times, there's actually some pretty deep theology that's lodged in there, but you might just skip right by it because Paul, an apostle called by God to the church at wait a second, what does that mean, an apostle called by God? I mean, if you really stop and dig in, there's a whole lot there even in a salutation. Well, it's the same way with the conclusion sometimes of a letter. I mean, you don't want to, you know, build a mountain out of something that's intended to be a molehill. I mean, if it's not supposed to be something huge, I mean, he's listing people, he's calling them fellow workers, beloved of the Lord, whatnot. But then they're right in the middle of kind of a whole list of names, and he's, you know, saying his goodbyes and whatnot. You get to verse 17, and he fires a kind of a warning at them about certain people that they need to keep an eye on. And I just found it interesting, the way it's just kind of the way it's obviously something Paul's concerned about, and he wants to warn them about it. And so I thought, you know what, that ties in with something I was already thinking about. And so we'll look at this passage tonight and kind of address it. The idea of church unity is an interesting concept because we want unity, but unity is not the paramount factor in a church or within Christianity. We want unity around the truth. And there's a difference between unity around the truth and just unity. And I notice a lot of times when I hear people bemoaning the facts, and I mean, I hear it frequently, well, you know, not in our church specifically. I'm talking about Christianity at large. Other pastors and things of that nature will say, well, it's just not enough unity in the body of Christ. That's the problem. You know, we're not a witness to the world because they see that we're divided. They see all these different denominations, all these different churches. Why can't we all just come together? I mean, maybe you've been asked that before. Maybe you've thought that before. How come we don't just have one church? Why aren't we all united? The Church of Lake Charles. Well, you know, I always tell other pastors, I'm fine with that as long as I get to be the pastor of it, so if you want to say one church in Lake Charles, every one of you start coming to Heritage Baptist Church, I'm not sure I'll let you stay, but go ahead and come and I'll be the pastor and then we'll have unity. Does that sound good to you? No, it doesn't sound good to them. And If I say something like that, of course, I mean, you know, I'm somewhat joking, but then again, somewhat not. Well, you know, you don't sound like you're very big on unity then. I mean, you think you're the only one that knows anything. No, I'm not the only one that knows anything, but I do think doctrine is important enough to divide over. There's a lot of things that aren't important enough to divide over that Christians divide over. The one thing that is important enough is doctrine. And that's what this verse says. I heard someone recently, a minister, someone in, I believe he was an evangelist, said, "Oh, we just got to quit having all these divisions over doctrine. Man, these churches are just dividing over doctrine and doctrine." And I'm thinking, the Bible says the exact opposite of what you just said. Because doctrine is the one thing that is important enough to divide over. I mean, we don't need to divide over piddly little things, but doctrine's worth dividing over. And that's what that verse says, verse 17. "Now I urge you, brethren, keep your eye," in other words, watch out, pay attention, "on those who cause dissensions and hindrances," or pitfalls, "contrary to the teaching which you learned, and turn away from them." And so when you first read that verse, and this is the kind of verse that the unity lovers will use. Look at this. "People like you that cause dissension, we should stay away from you because we all want to be united." Well, notice what Paul says, who to turn away from. The dissension is caused by what? They're teaching false doctrine. That's why Paul says turn away from them. And so a lot of times under the guise of unity, you'll actually have a lot of division that's brought forth into a church. And that's, it's almost, it's ironic the way it works, whereby you'll be accused of being divisive because you stand for a particular doctrine. You say, "Well, this, you know, I'm not budging on this. The Bible teaches this, and I'm not budging on it." "Oh, well, you're being divisive." Now, wait a second. Who's being divisive? You're the one trying to get me to obey or disobey the Bible, and I can't be united with you unless I disobey the Bible, and that makes me divisive? How does that not make you divisive? Now, think about it. I mean, what is of primary importance? It's nice to have church unity. It's even nice to have, you know, Christian unity, brothers and sisters in Christ, and we can get along, and I mean, that's all good, but unity, if you throw truth out the window, that's not real unity. That's a joke. That's the illusion of unity. And this is the kind of thing you have sometime. I read just last week about it wasn't here, it was in California, an interfaith worship service. The one I heard about here was an interdenominational worship service. Well, okay, whatever. But the one I heard about in California was interfaith, which it was Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Wiccans, whatever. Everything under the sun coming together. And I'm like, what is the point of this? This is not a worship service. I mean, it's a charade. But the idea, and if someone who was strong in their Christian beliefs said, "I'm not taking part in that, that's a charade, that's a joke, that's not a worship service," "Oh, you're divisive. You're divisive." Well, that's what I'm saying. No, I'm not divisive. I mean, you're insisting that I throw the Bible out the window and come unite. Well, that's not real unity. If you got to throw Jesus out the door, then that's not a group I'm interested in being a part of. And it's, it's an interesting phenomenon. One of the things I heard a fellow say recently is, and here's where a lot of times this will come into play, is when you have crusades and things of that nature, where we need all the Christian community to come together, and we're going to have this evangelist. And I remember I took part in one 20 years ago. I was a brand new Christian, and I mean, I was excited about serving the Lord, and I wasn't going to be a preacher at that time, but I was, you know, I wanted to do what my church wanted me to do. And so I helped out in any way I could. And there was this citywide crusade. All the churches are coming together. I mean, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, you name it. Several churches that I, now I would say they wouldn't even be Orthodox. They wouldn't even be, I wouldn't even define them as Christian. But this was unity was over everything. I mean, that was all that was. We don't need to get into all the doctrinal stuff. Let's avoid doctrine and just talk about Jesus. Now, what's the problem with that statement? You can't talk about Jesus apart from doctrine. I've heard this numerous times as well. I mean, I remember when I was in seminary, we'd get a who's who of big shot Southern Baptist preachers that would come in and speak in chapel. And I mean, you know, cream of the crop. Arminian free will, most of them, not all of them, most of them. And it was always the same thing. Well, we got too much doctrinal division in the convention. We just need to focus on the gospel. Yeah, forget all the doctrine and just focus on the gospel. Some of my professors would be pulling their hair out saying, how are you dividing doctrine and gospel? How do you preach the gospel apart from doctrine? What gospel are you going to preach? Who are you going to talk to and what are you going to tell them? That all involves doctrine, doesn't it? Who is Jesus? What did he do? Who did he do it for? You can't share the gospel apart from doctrine. The gospel is doctrine. It is theology. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting to hear people say things like that. And so this fellow I heard recently had made the comment. He said, well, we're trying to get people united and just everybody come together and all the churches come together. We got too much division, this, that, and the other. And he made the statement, well, you know, there's some preachers that they're opposed to unity. They don't want to see churches united. And it kind of dawned on me, you know, I think he's talking about me. Or he's talking about my kind. Because anytime there's this big, you know, community-wide, well, let's all come together and have joint services and do pulpit swaps and all that kind of stuff, I say, I'm not playing. I don't do that. Wow, you're just not on unity. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with me being opposed to a particular denomination or a group of people or anything like that. I just don't want heretics preaching at my church. No offense, but I just don't want heretics preaching at my church. And so I'm not willing to just say, oh, let's be united, and then every doctrinal truth we stand on, we just toss out the window and say, well, at least we're united. United around what? I mean, there's nothing to unite around if you toss the Bible aside. Now, there are issues that Christians fight over that aren't worth fighting over. I mean, not just Christians, just life in general, right? I mean, you've probably argued with your spouse over things that later you thought, well, that really wasn't worth that big of a fight. Or kids do that sort of thing. My kids sometimes will fight over who gets to sit in what seat in the car or something like that. And, you know, it's World War III, and I'm like, this is not that important. We don't need to divide the family over this. I can assign seats real fast. And, you know, the look when daddy's looking in the rearview mirror and the kids, you remember that look when your dad would look up with eyes blazing. My son has seen that before more times than he cares to admit. Well, those things aren't worth dividing over, but the gospel's worth dividing over. It's worth it. Jesus is worth dividing over if necessary. And so let's look at this passage. Let's break it down just a little bit. First of all, in verse 17, the awareness of doctrinal divisions. Be aware of it, Paul says in verse 17. He says, now I urge you, brethren, keep your eye on those who cause dissensions and hindrances contrary to the teaching which you learned, and turn away from them. And so he says, keep your eye on or watch. The word means to watch with a cautious eye. You know, like if you're walking down the sidewalk and your neighbor's Rottweiler is not on a leash, and so you don't want to make a big deal, but you're going to just kind of keep an eye on that because there may be trouble there. Well, that's what Paul says about these people. They're divisive. They cause dissensions. And some of the times, the way they cause dissensions is by preaching unity. That's what I'm saying is the big interesting thing. It's kind of like in society at large how the tolerance is a big thing right now. And who are the people that will hammer you for being intolerant? They're the most intolerant ones there are, right? Yeah. Oh, you're intolerant. Well, you just accused me of something. Doesn't that make you intolerant? I have to hold to your view or I'm intolerant? You know what I'm saying? And so a lot of times those who are pushing unity are the ones who are really dividing churches. And so it has to be, as Paul says here, watch. Watch them carefully. Pay attention to what they're doing. And when you hear them teaching something contrary to what you were taught, what does he say to do? Turn away. I'm not having a joint service. I'm turning away from you. We're not going to join hands and sing Kumbaya. Sorry. All right, so he talks about dissensions, and there's various types of dissensions, you know, here in verse 17. It says, keep an eye on those who cause dissensions and hindrances. The dissensions, I mean, when you think about it, there are various types, there are various levels of possible dissensions in the church. Some of them, I mean, sometimes things are bad enough, you leave a church over some dissensions. Some dissensions you don't. Some dissensions you work through somehow. I saw a church one time that their morning service started at 11:07, I think it was, 11:07. And I talked to the pastor. I said, that's kind of a strange starting time, isn't it? Yeah, well, there's a story there. I said, I bet there is. What is it? Well, half the church wanted to start at 11. Half of them wanted to start at 11:15. And it was going to split the church. And even at that, the 11:15 crowd is mad because we didn't make it 11:08. Made 11:07. So we gave that extra minute to the 11 o'clock. I said, listen, brother, you got bigger problems in your church than what time your service starts. I mean, if you're splitting the church over 11:07 versus 11:08, those aren't the kind of things you divide over, right? I mean, that's just not that big a deal. On things like that, and you know, every church has issues that come up where people don't agree. Well, I think we should do this. Well, I think we should do that. Non-doctrinal issues, whereby you say, you know what, well, we got to figure out what to do. You show forbearance toward one another and you work through issues. Even within the realm of doctrine, there are some issues that aren't worth dividing a church over. There's, for the most part, agreement on doctrinal issues at Heritage Baptist Church, for the most part. We have a doctrinal statement. We have things that make us different, make us unique in a doctrinal sense as it pertains to other churches. But there's not complete agreement on everything. We shouldn't divide over everything necessarily. Millennial views. I mean, everybody in the church is not required to have a certain millennial view. There's various views on spiritual gifts in terms of cessationism versus non-cessationism. And there's a place in Romans 14 where Paul kind of addresses issues that are doctrinal but lesser, which is to say they're not worth splitting a church over. And Paul addressed issues of food and also issues of those who elevate a particular day. You can see the Sabbath issue perhaps in play there. And this is what Paul says, Romans chapter 14, verse 1. He says, now accept the one who is weak in faith, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on his opinions. All right? You get a brand new Christian in the church, accept him, but not for the purpose of mocking him and ridiculing him and saying, well, don't you know anything? I mean, Paul says, don't do that. You want to help him grow. He goes on, he says, one person has faith that he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats vegetables only. The one who eats is not to regard with contempt the one who does not eat, and the one who does not eat is not to judge the one who eats, for God has accepted him. All right, so there's an issue right there with food. Paul says, all right, you got some people in church, they say, I don't eat anything but vegetables. Well, what do you do about that? Paul says, let them eat vegetables. You want to eat nothing but vegetables? Fine, you eat nothing but vegetables. But you who eat vegetables, Don't look down on the people that eat T-bone steaks. I mean, really, in our society, this isn't as big of a deal on food. But when you look at what the early church was dealing with, those who had come out of Judaism, I mean, can you imagine how it was ingrained in you, those dietary laws? And then it's like that quick, Peter has a dream, and really earlier than that, Jesus declared all things clean, and Peter has that dream, and now it's okay to eat things that it has been driven into your head your whole life not to eat. So if you had Christians in the early church from a Jewish background who said, look, I know it's not a sin, I can't eat pork, all right? I just can't bring myself to do it. I know it's not a sin, I just can't do it. The smell of it makes me sick. It's been ingrained in me from the day I was born not to eat it. I just can't do it. I know it's not a sin. I'm not saying it's a sin. You want to eat it, fine. Well, what Paul is saying here is if that's how that person is, then you don't go get a pork chop and try to shove it down their throat and say, you need to prove your worth as a Christian. Paul says, leave them alone. Let them eat how they want to eat. You eat how you want to eat. This is not an issue worth dividing over. He goes on, Paul does, and talks about particular days. In Romans 14, verse 5, he says, one person regards one day above another, another regards every day alike. Each person must be fully convinced in his own mind, which is Paul saying what? Not a big deal. This is a death blow to Sabbatarians, by the way. I mean, if you are adamant that, no, we still keep the Sabbath, it's just moved to Sunday, and you read Romans 14 and Paul says, if you want to elevate a day, fine. You don't want to, that's fine too. I mean, what Paul says here, I think it disturbs some people. Now, Paul wouldn't be talking about the Sabbath anyway. The Sabbath was fulfilled, and clearly so. That's clearly taught. Paul taught that very clearly in Colossians, and whoever wrote Hebrews taught it too. But some people would say, well, but Sunday's a special day, and in the early church it came to be called the Lord's Day. And you might see Sunday as a special day. To me, it's pretty clearly a day that is different than the other six. For example, we have two church services on Sunday. That's different. We don't do that the other 6 days of the week. In many societies, Saturday and Sunday are your days off, not always, around here especially, because people work funny schedules. But as a general rule, Sunday works in our culture, in our society, for a day to set apart for worship. Now, some people, depending upon the household, have different rules, if you will, for their family. In some households, look, it's a day of rest. I mean, maybe they hold to a Sabbath principle, maybe they don't. Maybe they just say, look, we're not Sabbatarians, but this is Sunday, it's a family day, it's a worship day, it's a rest day. All the stuff you usually do, you're not doing it today. That may be the scruples that that family holds to. What Paul says is, if that's what you hold to, by all means. You have every right to do that. But you don't have the right to force your personal scruples on somebody else and say, hey, this is how my family does it. This is how your family has to do it too. As it pertained to the Old Covenant Sabbath, Paul would have never said something like this. Do whatever you want. Some people see it as elevate one day. Some people don't. Let each be convinced in his own way. You would have never said that about the Old Covenant Sabbath. There was no wiggle room on that. And so you have certain issues that aren't worth dividing over. You don't have to divide over things like that. Other issues are worth dividing over. And that's a lot of times is sometimes a discernment issue, trying to figure out which ones, okay, well, what's important enough that, I'm going to go to the wall on this one. I think clearly if it pertains to the gospel, when you have doctrinal issues that pertain to the gospel, because here in Romans where Paul says, hey, if they teach you something and they're creating division based on a teaching that you didn't receive from us, in other words, they're teaching something contrary to what we taught you, turn away from that. It's very similar to what Paul says in Galatians 1 when he warns of those preaching another gospel. I mean, this is more than just, they've got some goofy views on Israel, or they've got different millennial views than me, or, their views on the Sabbath aren't the same as mine. This is heaven and hell at stake. This is gospel stuff in Galatians chapter 1, where Paul says they're preaching another gospel. This is not, come on, too much division, let's just unite. No, you don't unite with those who are preaching another gospel. In fact, Paul says, let them be anathema. Let them be accursed. They're hellbound, and they're trying to convince you of the wide road that leads to hell. You don't unite over that. And some of the Galatians were. I mean, they were getting sucked in. And Paul's like, well, who has bewitched you people? I mean, Paul, you read through Galatians, that's some of the strongest language that Paul uses in the whole New Testament. When he talks to the Galatians about, what on earth are you people thinking? I mean, did I labor over you in vain? I mean, you know, it's a shyster comes in a month after I'm gone and you just follow this false gospel? Obviously, Paul thought that was an issue worth dividing over. You don't unite with those preaching a false gospel. It's very similar to what Paul talked about in 2 Corinthians 11, where he actually mentions another Jesus, if they preach another Jesus. And we have cults in our world today that preach another Jesus, not just another gospel, but another Jesus. I mean, the Jesus they describe to you is not the Jesus of the Bible. I talked about that a couple years ago. Remember, I had the Mormon girl witnesses come by my house. And, I was loaded for bear. I mean, I was ready to go at it with these, in a loving way. I wasn't, you know. But I just thought, and so I talked to them out in my driveway there. It ended up being for a couple hours. Well, I said, you know what, you all believe this and this and this. I'm not sure if we do or not. I'll have to ask my elder about that. Well, yeah, you do, and you know this and this and this. And I just kept on. I mean, I was ready to do war with these gals, and these poor girls, they didn't even know what Mormons believed. They were Mormon missionaries. I said, you all preach another Jesus. The Jesus you describe is not the Jesus of the Bible. They didn't have the foggiest idea what I was talking about. I said, girls, what kind of missionary training did they give you? Didn't they teach you how to deal with an obnoxious Baptist preacher? And the girls said, sir, we only had 8 days of training. I said, well, you girls need to come down to my church, and why don't you come visit us? Of course, they wanted to work a deal, and see, this is what I'm talking about. I'll tell you what, why don't you come to our church? I said, girls, I'm a pastor. I can't just show up at your church. I kind of have a job. I work on Sundays. I'm a preacher. You come to my church. You're not a preacher. Well, you come to ours and we'll come. I said, I'm not coming to yours, so I'll be glad to talk to you again, but I just told you in my driveway that your church is heretical. So why would I go there? I'm telling you the truth, and I can prove it in the Bible. Why don't you come and talk to me? Well, we got some questions. We got to go back and talk to our elder. Never saw those girls again. They still worked my neighborhood, but they would do a wide swath around my house. You know, Andrew remembers this. He'd see them outside. Hey, Dad, those missionaries are outside again. I'd run out and grab my rake, and I'd sit there, just, you know, acting like I was working. Anybody in the neighborhood would look and say, he's faking it. He doesn't ever do yard work. So, hey, it was, yep, just don't. And that's no kidding, though, because if they get caught in somebody that engages them a little bit and they go back to the higher-ups, they'll say, don't even, just avoid them. Probably for the same reason. You talk to folks like that, and if they, especially them, some of them younger ones like that, I mean, if the girls tell me the truth, we had 8 days of training. They're not equipped to handle anybody who knows anything. I'm not saying that because I'm a pastor, I was, any Christian who knows their Bible at all could have tied these girls in a theological knot. I mean, they were just, they didn't know what Mormons believed, and they were Mormons. So when we tell you what Mormons believe, they preach another Jesus. The Jesus they talk about. Say, oh, yeah, we're the Church of Jesus Christ. We're Christians. Well, actually, historically, the Mormons didn't like being called Christians. They wanted to be called Mormons because they believed Christianity was corrupt. I'm kind of getting off track a little bit, but suffice it to say, if the Mormons come to me and want to have a joint worship service, it's not going to be happening. Because that's a doctrinal issue worth dividing over. All right, now, you've got doctrinal divisions here, and he also uses this word, hindrances, in verse 17. Keep an eye on those who cause dissensions and hindrances contrary to the teaching which you learned, and turn away from them. Hindrances can be translated stumbling block or pitfall. There's a lot of different ways to translate that word from the Greek. And so when you hear that word, you say, well, what's he talking about here? People who throw up hindrances. Immediately, I think of Judaizers. I mean, considering the society he's in, well, you think of the Judaizers who were, you know, pushing the law so much in the early church. You can't be saved unless you're circumcised. Tell them they must adhere to the law of Moses. Albert Barnes, a New Testament scholar of times past, he said, probably here he refers to Jewish teachers or those who insisted strenuously on the observance of the rites of Moses and who set up a claim for greater purity and orthodoxy than those possessed who received the Gentile converts as Christian brethren. The Jews were perpetually recalling the Christian converts to the law of Moses, insisting on the observance of those rites, troubling the churches and producing dissensions and strife. And Paul addresses that in numerous places. And so that's what he's saying here. I mean, in one sense, it could be Jews, people of a Jewish background who are causing hindrances and pitfalls and throwing things out there in front of people saying, well, you have to do this to be saved. You have to do this to be saved. But really, when you think about it, it could either be those of a legalistic persuasion or it could be those who swing all the way in the other direction who are causing dissension and hindrances to the gospel, because you have that as well. You got legalists over here, you got what you might say liberals over here who would teach, oh, we're all going to heaven. What are you talking about? What do you mean sin? No, God loves you. He would never send anyone to hell. What are you talking about? Listen, that person is throwing stumbling blocks out there just as much as the legalist is. You see what I'm saying? Both of them are perverting the gospel. And it doesn't matter if they're mean about it or if they're nice about it, they're both heretical in what they're doing. You know, the mean, angry legalist who says, you must do the law, you must be circumcised, versus a guy who's a polar opposite, nice, sweet liberal with a nice little sweater on, saying, oh, no, you're not a sinner, God would never condemn you. I mean, don't listen to those preachers that tell you need Jesus, as though a good, honest Hindu wouldn't go to heaven. I mean, you don't believe that, do you? Listen, that's a heretic and that's a heretic. They're both heretics. They're both teaching a false gospel. They're both throwing pitfalls and dissensions in front of people. And those are the type of things you hear in churches all around us that are under the guise of Christian. Now, that's not to say every single person at every single one of these churches is an unbeliever. There's plenty of Christians that go to churches other than ours. I don't want to pretend like we're the only ones that have any regenerate membership whatsoever. But how many churches could you go to that either have a list of works you must do to be saved, or they go to the other extreme and are universalist in their outlook and teach that everybody's pretty much going to heaven? That's a lot of different places that would teach either a legalistic brand of do all these things or everybody's in. Now, well, let's have a joint service with those folks. That's what Paul's saying here. No, turn away from that. Don't be linked up with that. And so you've got dissensions, you've got hindrances. And he says, and it's interesting the phrase he uses, when you see that type of teaching, and that type of teaching, for example, is in your church or it's creeping into your church, Paul doesn't say run over and embrace it. He says turn away from that. And the phrase turn away, you know, that's a phrase that Paul uses in 2 Timothy 4, verse 3. He says, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and they will turn away from the truth. Turn away from the truth. Paul says to do the same thing, except he says to do it with error. If you receive a teaching that is not what you receive, it's contrary to what you receive from us, turn away from that. Everybody's turned away from something, aren't they? You're either turning away from the truth or you're turning away from a lie. Paul says turn away from the lies. Embrace the truth. Now, the interesting part is how do you handle various groups? I mean, there's one thing that you would do in a church, in a local church. You have a common belief system that you hold to. But what do you do, for example, when you go out into the world and you're surrounded by people clearly unregenerate who have really bad theology? Well, guess what? Every unregenerate person, most unregenerate people have very bad theology. I say most because there are some who know theology pretty well, and yet they're unregenerate. I've told this story many times about a guy I used to work with in a tire shop for 2 years. Him and I would talk theology for hours. He was intelligent. He was well-versed. He was well-read. He was an atheist. He knew what I believed, though. I mean, I didn't have to explain to him, not only as a Christian, but as the type of Christian I was, as a Baptist and doctrines of grace, that he knew all of that. He just didn't believe any of it. Now, I mean, you go out into the world, nobody believes like you do. I mean, there's people, they all kinds of strange beliefs. Well, Paul tells us, as it pertains to the unregenerate, should we avoid them? Paul says the exact opposite, doesn't he? Because you remember when he told to the Corinthians, and they thought, well, I guess we just can't leave our house because the immoral people are everywhere. And Paul wrote to them in 1 Corinthians 5, he said, I wrote my letter not to associate with immoral people. I did not mean at all the immoral people of the world or with the covetous and swindlers and idolaters, for then you'd have to go out of the world. Actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he is an immoral person or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or a swindler, not to even eat with such a one. So Paul says there, and when he says not to eat with such a one, he's not saying that if you're sitting in McDonald's and someone comes in who claims to be a Christian and you know they're not, I can't eat with him and burst out of that. That's not what he's saying. He's saying don't give the illusion that you embrace their teaching. Having a meal with somebody was a big deal in that culture. It's not quite as big of a deal in our culture, but it can be. Paul's saying, don't do anything to show that, make it look like you're embracing their claims of Christianity while they live like heathens. But lost people don't know theology by and large. And our job as witnesses is to teach them the truth about God. And so he's not talking about avoiding them. What about professing Christians with bad theology? Should we engage them? Should we avoid them? They need to be taught. Engage them. Anybody else have any thoughts? Professing Christians with... Okay, is Paul saying don't have anything to do with any professing Christians if they have bad theology?
No. They said bad teaching. But I think bad theology is, well, according to what Paul said there, is these people, to my understanding, at the end of Romans there, is the doctrine is jacked up and they know it's jacked up. As opposed to,
you might be sitting under bad theology now and not know it too. Now you
it's on the page, brother. It's not flipping and twisting, you know what I mean?
Now you just sit under bad jokes. Which is better.
But I mean, I think from what I understand here is it's the person knows. They know.
Well, right. Well, look at verse 18. For such men are slaves, not of our Lord Christ, but of their own appetites, and by their smooth and flattering speech, they deceive the hearts of the unsuspecting. They're snake oil salesmen. They're, oh boy, evangelists. I've seen some evangelists that just make my flesh crawl. They're just sleazy. Well, and that's kind of what I'm getting at. When you have, for example, you see some of the TV preachers. Who could fall for that? I can't believe anybody would send a dime to someone named Dollar. Never mind. But you look at this, and I mean, what they're teaching, I mean, who could fall for that? Lots of people fall for that. Lots of people do. And I think he mentions it in verse 18. He calls them the unsuspecting. You've got naive people. Yes, ma'am.
They're like the Mormons. They don't know.
They don't know.
They want their ears tickled.
Well, some of them, they've been taught this from day one, right? I mean, that's all they've ever been taught. Now, as to, back to my main question, do we engage them? Do we avoid them? And sometimes you can't tell at first, can you? And here, let me give you a couple of examples from the Bible. What did Paul do? He's a Christian, right? He goes into Jewish synagogues, and he preaches the gospel. Remember, we talked about this last week from Acts 17. Paul goes to the synagogue in Thessalonica, and he goes in, he preaches the gospel, and some of them believed, and others of them formed a mob and ran him out of town. Now, in the case of a synagogue, it's not necessarily full of heretics. Some of the people there just have a partial understanding of the truth. Let me put it that way. Right? They're Jews. They don't know about Christ. Maybe they haven't heard the gospel. And so what they know in terms of their Judaism, for the most part, is undoubtedly correct. But there's more to the story, and they haven't heard it. And Paul comes in and preaches Christ from the Old Testament scriptures. And now some of them believe by God's grace, right? Now, how would they have believed? How shall they hear without a preacher? Didn't somebody say that one time? Yeah, that was Paul too. How shall they hear without a preacher? Well, we can't avoid every person on the planet who's got bad theology, because this is going to offend you, but you used to have bad theology. And somebody corrected you. Some Christian came to you in some way, shape, form, or fashion, either a neighbor or a church or a pastor. Somebody came to you. And so, obviously, when Paul says turn away from those, he's not saying turn away from every Christian, professing Christian, who's got bad theology. In fact, here's another example, Apollos. I've used this example before. Apollos came, and he was preaching, and he was eloquent, and he was smart, and he was from Alexandria, which was a very educated city, and he was a Jew. I mean, he just had all kinds of things going for him, except he wasn't quite right on the gospel. Remember? And Priscilla and Aquila, husband and wife, tent makers, in fact, they worked with Paul. They took him aside and explained the way of God more accurately to him. He was partially right, but not completely right. Now, Priscilla and Aquila didn't say, turn away from him. Paul would tell us to turn away from him. No, they go and correct him, and he accepts that. Now, if they go to correct him, and he goes off on a tangent about a false gospel, at that point, turn away. You see what I'm saying? You see the difference? There's a difference. Or if he even says, I hadn't thought of that. I'll have to think about that. Let me pray about that, or something like that. Well, you don't turn away at that point either. You know, well, the Lord's working on him. Give him time, all right? You didn't come out of the womb knowing everything. The Lord chose to use time to open your eyes. Let the Lord do that with other people too. But what Paul's speaking about is people who come into the church, they divide with a false gospel. And that's what I started off with tonight. A lot of times it's this false call for unity that's not really unity. Oh, we can't be arguing about, whether or not It's sovereignty versus free will. I mean, we shouldn't argue over things like that. Let's just all love Jesus. The sovereignty of God is a pretty big concept in the Bible. You can't just toss that one aside and say, no, well, that's divisive. We don't want to go there. No, we do want to go there. And we want to stay there. All right, so it's not as though we just completely avoid. We do try to engage. Just like Paul, here's another example, my last example of Paul in the synagogue. There was a time in which Paul preached to the Jews, you remember? And some believed and some didn't. And that's always how it is, no matter who you're preaching to. But you remember there was a time in which they were blaspheming and they were just on and on. And Paul finally says, all right, that's enough. I'm going to the Gentiles. You remember that? Shook the dust off his feet and said, I've had enough. There's a time in which you get there with people sometimes. People that are so militant against the gospel, God's going to have to change their heart, and he's not doing it right now. But maybe he's changing somebody else's. Nice talking to you. I'm going to go talk to somebody else. I mean, sometimes some Christians are such obnoxious evangelists, they'll just want to beat people to death with the gospel, and it's obvious God's not moving in that person's heart. Well, I just haven't told them enough. I heard a statistic one time. The average person's got to hear the gospel 7 times before they accept it. Well, statistics, when it comes to the sovereignty of God, is worthless. And so I think this guy I knew would purposely sit there and repeat it 7 times, thinking, well, according to statistics, this guy's going to get saved on number 7. That's not how God works. All right. Well, and we've already hit on this, but the appetites of the dividers here in verse 18, for such men are slaves, not of our Lord Christ, but of their own appetites. I was telling kids today, you know what? Everybody's a slave of someone or something. Everyone's a slave. Anytime you, I'm my own man, boy, I just, you know, no, you're not. You're a slave of someone. You're either a slave to sin, you're a slave of Christ. Either a slave to Satan, slave to righteousness. All those phrases are used in the Bible. You're a slave, you're somebody's slave. I remember one time, I thought this was pretty clever, actually. A guy was witnessing out on the street, and he had one of those sandwich signs, you know, a board on this side and a board on this side. And on the front it said, everyone's a slave to someone. And on the back side it said, whose slave are you? Trust in Jesus. As an attention getter. Because nobody wants to be, oh no, I'm my own man. No, you're not. Well, Paul says that these people here, they're slaves, but they're not slaves of the Lord. True Christians are slaves of the Lord, and the Lord is a gracious master. These people are slaves to their own appetite, to their own belly, as the King James would put it. They're not interested. They're not really interested in uniting the church unless it's around them and what they want to do. And he goes on to describe them, notice this, by their smooth and flattering speech, they deceive the hearts of the unsuspecting. Oh, they're snake oil salesmen. They're slime. Paul says, eh. And so when I get encountered by someone, oh, we're having a get-together, we're having an evangelist come in. Boy, he's a smooth talker. Boy, he's a good, we're going to get all churches together. We're going to forget all this doctrinal division. I'm just sitting there with sirens going off saying, I'll not be taking part. Thank you for the invitation. Because Paul says to avoid the very type of people you're describing. That crusade I'd worked with 20 years ago, I'll never forget. I mean, I volunteered to do anything they wanted me to do. Of course, they wanted me to take up offering. You know, I was a 20-year-old, you know. And I had to go to training to take up the offering. Yeah, it doesn't quite take a PhD to do this, but okay. Well, this guy was a huckster. He was with the evangelism team, and I mean, he was adamant. No matter what happens at that service, no matter what happens, the primary, most important thing is that this offering gets taken up and taken up correctly. Here's what we need you to do. You be here, you be here. I mean, they had them stationed everywhere. You come out with the buckets just as soon as the guy says the announcement. We want this perfect. And I'll never forget the guy saying it. He says, no matter what has happened to you that day, no matter how lousy of a day you've had, you be sure to paint a big smile on your face. And I remember him saying this. He says, I'm giving you permission to be a hypocrite. Because we don't want people, we want people to give. And they're more likely to give. I'm kind of falling into his Alabama accent a little bit there too. And more likely to give if you got a smiling face. This guy was a huckster. And you know what happened? We had that crusade. And I mean, the altar call. And I mean, they're driving it home. We had probably 1,000 people come over the course of that week. I think maybe 2 or 3 people went forward at the whole, which altar call. I'm not big on that anyway. But that whole crusade was an absolute dud. And then immediately people start making excuses for it. Well, it's because we didn't pray enough. Or it's because, I say, you know what the problem was? Is you had a heretic in the pulpit and a whole bunch of heretics with his organization there running the whole thing. I didn't perceive all that at the time because I didn't know anything either. But looking back, ooh, smooth, flattering talk. Dissension, hindrance. Oh, we all want to be united. Nah, they're con men. Avoid them, Paul says. Avoid them. And let's end with this, verse 19. For the report of your obedience has reached to all. So Paul says, you're not like them. Don't be like them. Don't embrace them. The report of your obedience has reached to all. Therefore, I'm rejoicing over you, but I want you to be wise in what is good and innocent in what is evil. Which you could preach a whole sermon on that phrase alone. Be wise. Know what's good and do that. And as it pertains to evil, be innocent. Don't get involved. Well, that's going to make you look divisive. It's much better to look divisive than to be guilty of evil, as he describes it here. Verse 20, the God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. The grace of our Lord Jesus be with you. And that's really what it all comes back to, isn't it? Grace. The grace of God. By the grace of God, I am what I am. And we're to live our lives in such a way that we honor the grace that God has given us. And we don't just toss it aside and say, oh, we want to be united. We want to be united around the truth. And if the truth isn't important to you, then I'm not going to unite with you. Sorry. All right. Questions? Comments?